You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello and welcome to MLB.com Extras. Talking American League East today, I'm Matthew Leach, and I will be joined by all five of MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. AL East continues to be the division that nobody saw coming. The Orioles have raised to a 10-game lead, the largest lead in baseball. They are counting down their magic number and not that far from probably talking about things like setting up their postseason rotation. Yankees and Blue Jays are still very much on the fringes of the postseason hunt, trying for a wild card spot in it and definitely thinking about the wild card. The Rays and Red Sox, we're talking a little about what to accomplish down the stretch and what they might be thinking about for this offseason for building 2015 clubs, because those are definitely both teams that will have expectations to be right back in the mix next year. So we'll be talking ball with some beat writers here on MLB.com Extras, American League East. Thanks for listening. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. The big news from the Orioles right about now pertains to J.J. Hardy, who has dealt with some injury issues. What's his situation at this moment as we talk?
They hope that he is playing on Friday. He got a MRI this afternoon right around 1. He had a cortisone injection in his SI joint, in his lower back, and the MRI was basically unchanged from April. Now, April is important because he missed six games, including 5 in a row, with low back spasms. He is saying that this isn't nearly as bad. It hasn't spasmed up quite yet, so they feel like they got in front of this. Hardy will remain in Baltimore, which is where he got examined today, for the next couple days. They don't want him to come back to Boston to fly again and really just keep aggravating that back. So he will come in on Thursday for the off day, get a little treatment, and they hope, like I said, that he's in Friday's lineup.
Back injuries tend to be worrisome, and they tend not to go away. Is this a case where they think they may have to manage it for the remainder of the season in October, or is it something where they feel like this should cover him into the off season?
Well, he's going to have about a week off by the time this all is said and done. So they've given him a really good chance for it to go away. I mean, I agree with you. I think they're nagging injuries, but he managed it really well from April up until now with that first cortisone injection. So there's no reason to believe that won't be the case again, and he won't be able to be a factor for them and not be limited by this back injury through the end of this month and beyond.
Is he maybe a guy that they proactively give an extra day or two even after this, just over these last 2.5 weeks for a team with a 10-game lead? Is Hardy maybe a guy that they look to give a breather here and there to use your term, stay ahead of it, just to make sure that this doesn't recur or that whatever, for a guy who works pretty hard, is he maybe a guy who'd get an extra day or two before the season's out?
Absolutely. They've done it already a couple times with a bunch of different guys. I don't see why Hardy would be any different. Steve Pierce had an abdominal strain. They took that real slow. Listen, the fact that they sent him back to Baltimore and they said that he probably could have played if the divisional race was a little closer tells you exactly that. So I think they're going to rest a bunch of guys down the stretch because they've really earned this luxury. They're in this position where not every game's going to matter at the end of September.
It's an interesting question. I think it's one we talked about before, but clubs sometimes do worry about doing too much of that. And I know we talked about it last week, but I think as it becomes more real, it's still worth examining. Does Buck Showalter have any worry about that line, about if you rest guys that maybe you lose a little of the edge?
I don't think so. I think really, I think the bigger issue is when you look at the teams that have had large divisional leads, and I did a big story for USA Today before I came to MLB.com about this very thing. They don't seem to fare well in the postseason. Really, it's the wild card winners. It's the teams that barely win the division that happen to get hot at the right time at the end of September that end up going deeper. So I think the bigger concern is not whether J.J. Hardy is going to be rusty from a day or two off. I think that's almost laughable. They've been playing since February. I think the bigger issue is playing in these games that don't mean anything for the last week or two of the season and then having to turn that switch back on for the postseason. To me, that's more dangerous.
And I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at is there's that whole psychological component, and I just wonder
right.
if you give guys a day or two, does it sort of further that notion? Again, I'm not against it. I just think it's an interesting question, and it's something that a manager has to address. If you give guys that extra day or two, does that even further that sort of mindset that maybe these games aren't as important as the ones earlier and risk that kind of, again, losing that mental edge?
Yeah, I agree with you. But then on the flip side, would you rather risk injury or risk running those guys out there who do need a couple days? I mean, you could really play both sides of the coin. Like I said, to me, it's more of a concern from the team standpoint than it is individually getting these guys rest, having to all of a sudden play in games that matter again. And depending on when they clinch the magic number, they could be playing in meaningless games, essentially, unless you're playing for the baseball's best record, for 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. And that is disturbing. When you think about how long of a period that is for baseball players who play meaningful games every night and been used to pedal to the metal since the season started in April, to all of a sudden kind of coast in, to me, is scary. To all of a sudden be the favorite, to be running over guys. Those are the teams, well, I hate to say it, those are the teams who end up fouling out early. And obviously that's not what the Orioles want to do.
You know as well as I do that Buck Showalter is a guy who's going to think about every possibility. What can he do? Is he even going to tell you guys, what can he do in that room to keep that mental edge? What is he thinking about doing to minimize that worry?
Well, I'm sure whatever he's thinking about doing, he's not going to share with us. But you're right. He does very much play into that mental side of the game. I think a lot of it is having guys like Nick Marte, Adam Jones, guys who I think it's going to be tough to take out of the lineup no matter what. I mean, Nick Marte just wanted to play every game when this team was a train wreck and, you know, kind of the laughing stock of the AL East. He's not going to want to not play now. And you look at guys like Nelson Cruz playing for possibly, you know, 40 home run season, you know, 100 plus RBIs. Or are you really going to want to rest him too much or kind of keep him locked in? So Buck's going to really have interesting moves to make, and I think that he was really going to have to heavily rely on the team personnel to kind of police themselves a little bit.
While we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, let's get a little farther ahead of ourselves. The O's have a really interesting rotation. I think you can make a case it's kind of a regular season rotation. It's very deep. There's a lot of guys who can get out, but there's not a Cy Young contender. There's not a guy that people around the country say that's the number one. So what would a playoff rotation for this club look like right now?
Well, I think Miguel Gonzalez, who pitched last night, has to be part of it. I would say Wei-Yin Chen and Chris Tillman, who's pitching tonight, would probably be 1-2. You can argue on the order the merits of matchups and the life of the lefty and a righty there. And then Gonzalez, honestly. Bud Norris certainly could be a candidate, but I think Kevin Gausman is better suited in the bullpen, given how deep they are into the season. And the 23-year-old has never pitched in August and September and certainly not in October in his career. So I think that's probably what you're looking at if the season were to end today.
And that kind of leads into one of the other things I was going to ask. With Gausman having, a little bit of experience in the bullpen, does that also maybe argue for him having that opportunity?
Yeah, and he also throws so hard. You can make the case that he could be the David Price for Tampa Bay in 08. But the guy in the bullpen that just comes out and is just throwing, you know, absolute fastballs that are in the upper 90s. I think Kevin Gausman could be that guy for them. He's really kind of coming to his own. And as you mentioned, that the pen isn't quite as foreign to him. He's had success, particularly last year, after he settled in a little bit to a real nice shot for them. So I think that's probably what's going to end up happening with him.
There was some comments over the weekend. Matt Wieter sounded pretty optimistic. Obviously, he's not part of the 2014 team, but as he goes into this winter, what do you think his 2015 looks like? Do you think there's a chance that this is a relatively normal season for him?
That's the hope, that this is a regular spring training and that he's ready to start the season. But you know, you can't make those promises. That's the same thing that the Orioles thought with Manny Machado, and look at the year that he had. Obviously, just wrecked by injuries and underperformance and it was never quite right, never the Manny Machado that he was last year. So with that being said, they are optimistic. They like where Matt Wieters is right now in his rehab, but he's still really in the infancy of that whole process. It's too early to say, well, will he be ready if he does this? Is he ahead of schedule? Is he behind schedule? The Royals really don't want to get into that too much. But obviously they're a better team, a better club, a stronger club with Matt Wieters, which – really, when coupled with Manny Machado, makes it even more remarkable what they're doing.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's something you've addressed. It's something we've tried to address on MLB.com. One of the things that's really come from that, one of the reasons they've been able to do that, is an amazing season from Steve Pierce. This guy was released, not just designated, not just whatever. He was released. And now he's a key part of this club and a guy they really miss when he's out. First, could you kind of explain that sequence that happened back in April where this guy found himself off the roster?
Sure. Well, they needed to make a spot on that team. And where they were pitching-wise, they really couldn't afford to go down another arm. Their starters really didn't turn it around until about late June. So Steve Pierce was really the only option. He was a guy who they thought about trading a couple times this spring. Didn't really pan out. Wanted to keep him on the roster. Wasn't getting a whole lot of at-bats. So, of course, they ended up getting rid of him. But they always wanted him to come back. He's very much a Buck Showalter type of guy. He grinds out his at-bats. He's very well-liked. I remember that day in Toronto, there was 10 players crowded around his locker talking to him. And, you know, that says a lot. You're in clubhouses. You've seen that. 10 guys is an awful lot of guys for a player who, at the time, was a marginal player. So the Orioles worked out a deal with him. He was claimed by Toronto, but he was eligible to reject that on the outright waiver claim, was eligible to say no, he didn't want to go there. The Orioles quickly re-signed him. They were able to find a loophole in the roster where they were able to add him right away. Somebody, I believe, was coming back from paternity, and Steve Pierce filled right in for Chris Davis, who was out. This is a guy who didn't have regular at-bats. You look at his career, he was a pretty well-thought-of prospect in Pittsburgh, never really had too much of an extended look. All of a sudden, now he's playing every day, and then you started to see Steve Pierce, who carried that team through June. He was absolutely phenomenal for them. He's had some peaks and valleys since then, but he's really been able to give the Orioles a shot in the arm. He's played great defense. He's given them some at-bats. He's well beyond his career high in games played and home runs and nearly every offensive statistic there is. So he's been a really good feel-good story for baseball. It's part of what makes baseball so cool. You know, this is a guy who didn't have a job midway through the season, and he gets named AL Co-Player of the Week, and he is a huge, huge part of what the Orioles are doing.
For sure. Well, Brittany Giroli, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter Brian Hoke. Brian, we generally try to look ahead in this. I think it's more valuable. I think it's more interesting. But sometimes you have something that's definitely worth looking back on. In this case, I would say that Derek Jeter Day would be something that would count as worth looking back on. Is there anything about that surprised you about how all that day went down?
You know, it was interesting. It was almost like you're looking back, and obviously there's so much to celebrate with Derek Jeter and so much that you want to take a look at, but then you look at the schedule and say, wait, there's 3 weeks still to go. So I think even for Derek, it was a bit strange to be in that situation where you do want to sit back, you want to appreciate it, you want to enjoy everything that's going on because, look, I mean, this is the last chance to see it. It's not going to happen again, but there's still games to play. And even Derek said, I thought that was a really great quote that he ended his speech with, you know, and he said, but we've got a game to play. So I think that in a lot of ways that summed up Derek Jeter. He's always looking forward to the next day. He always wants to get on the field and play. But I think for the fans and for his former teammates and everybody, the personnel that came out, it was just a very cool day to celebrate what Derek has meant to the franchise for 20 years now.
For you personally, were there any moments that stood out, any personal kind of favorite cool things that you saw?
I was not expecting to see Michael Jordan. To be in the same room with Michael Jordan was pretty cool. You know, and you get spoiled. You see Cal Ripken and Dave Winfield and guys like that, and it's, oh, you know, they belong at the baseball stadium. But when you see somebody who's kind of out of place, and I know we don't have to talk about Michael's baseball career, I think of Michael as a basketball player, and to see him, I probably should have thought of that with the Nike connection, and, you know, obviously they go way back. But to see Michael Jordan walk on the field and then to be later in that room was pretty cool.
Just think about being Michael Jordan for a minute. Hey, yeah, I sat in Roger Federer's box, and then I dropped in and said hi to Derek Jeter. It was a pretty cool week.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're Michael Jordan, you get to do those things.
I guess he earned it. Have you seen anything from Jeter? Did you see anything from Jeter that day that you weren't expecting? I mean, he's handled this all. He's obviously handled it differently from Rivera because they're different people. But have you started to see any kind of for lack of a better term, cracks at all in the sort of stoicness with which he's handled all this?
I thought the post-game news conference, I thought I saw a little bit of wobbly there, and he even admitted that when he was speaking, the microphone in his hand was shaking a little bit, and you know, you'd have to really go back and look at the video closely to see that, but I think that you're also seeing some of the humanity of Derek Jeter. I think he's been so guarded for so long, and I think that's why he's survived and done so well in New York City. But this year in particular, he's kind of opened that up a little bit. And I think that here's a great example. When the reporter's cell phone started ringing during the press conference and Derek picked it up and answered and said, she's going to have to call you back, buddy. I think there's a window into the Derek Jeter that everybody has been saying you'll never see. That's behind closed doors. He's a really funny guy. He's got personality, but he just doesn't want to show it to the press. And I think you're starting to see it a little bit. I think you see the walls coming down a little bit because he realizes there's really nothing to protect here. His legacy is pretty secure. There's no reason to play defense. It's just let it out there and be yourself and enjoy it because it's not going to last forever.
I don't want to get too far into pop psychology, but I do wonder, do you think that's a matter of like you say, him just, there's no need to put up the fight anymore? Or do you think there's any part of him that kind of wants people to see a little more of him at this point? In other words, do you think there's any part of him that almost finds it off-putting some of the ways he's been described, how almost mechanical some of his interactions with people are?
That may be part of it, but I think he really has been touched. I sense that by the outpouring of love and emotion that has come his way, not just at Yankee Stadium, but everywhere where the Yankees have gone this year. Nobody has a bad word to say about the guy. He gets gifts everywhere they go. I think that, you know, on some level, you just have to take a step back and smile and say, wow, this is pretty neat. You know, I can't believe I've touched so many people. And 20 years playing shortstop for the Yankees, a lot of people have come to the ballpark to see him play. He's obviously met a lot of people. People have enjoyed what he's done. I think that this has been a year, start to finish, where people have repeatedly told him how much he has meant to them. And I think that on some level, that has to let your guard down.
Yeah, do you think that he's been surprised any? I mean, after seeing Rivera, I can't imagine there's that much that's surprising. But do you think he's been surprised at all by how this has gone?
Here's the thing about him with Mo. First of all, he was hurt for most of the year, so I don't actually think he saw very much of the Mariano thing. Obviously, had he bothered to turn on the television and watch the Yankee games, I'm sure he would have seen it, and you know, I'm sure he flipped around and couldn't help but see some of it. But I think he missed a lot of last year with Mo, so I don't think he knew exactly what was going to happen. And you know, Rivera was asked several times if he would talk to Jeter about it. Jeter was asked the same question on the flip, and they both said that, no, they hadn't really talked about what to expect or what it would be like. So I think that Jeter pretty much went into the year with open expectations or no expectations, really, and just wanted to be surprised by everything. And that's what he said on Sunday, too, on Derek Jeter Day. He didn't want to know what was going to happen. He kind of had an idea that Jordan was in town for that because he'd heard that he was around New York and usually they would hang out or hit each other up. But for the most part, I think he's tried to focus on the baseball playing aspect of it, and the rest of it's just kind of gravy.
And now for anybody who has endured 6 minutes of Derek Jeter that maybe they didn't want, we apologize to you and we start talking baseball. We talk about it nearly every week, but it seems like there's still steady but positive news with Masahiro Tanaka. Where is he at right now, and what's the kind of situation with him with 3 weeks left in the season?
Pretty much the same as when we discussed it last week. You know, he's been throwing. They're talking bullpens. They're talking sim games at this point. Is he going to get into a game or not down the stretch? I can't tell you that. It's looking more like he won't, but they're going to keep him throwing because really, even if he can't get in a game at the end of this month, they need to know what the situation is with him. They want to keep him throwing into October, actually. He'll go down to Tampa, and they'll find somebody for him to throw to. You know, they'll have somebody stand in against him and simulate game conditions because they need to know, is this guy going to be on the mound for them in March, April, May, June of next year, or is this a situation where they're going to have the surgery? So you're going to keep getting updates on Tanaka for quite some time unless something does go wrong.
Sometimes a guy really wants to kind of prove it to himself that he can get back on the mound. You see this, I think you see it more with pitchers, where a guy just wants to get out there and throw one time, throw one inning, just show to himself that he's back. Do you think there's any of that with Tanaka, or do you think if he just kind of gets to where he can throw in a sim game or whatever and feel good, that that'll be good enough?
Yeah, I think obviously he wants to get back on the mound, but I asked that question when the Yankees were in Detroit. I asked Girardi, is there value in having him just come back out of the bullpen? That was the day that he'd thrown 49 pitches, I believe, on the mound. And okay, maybe he's not built up where he could start, but would there be value in him coming back just to throw an inning or two or work out of the bullpen? And Girardi at that time shot it down. Maybe that has changed. I think the question is worth asking again, especially considering the standing situation where it looks like the Yankees might not be playing meaningful games in the last week or two of the year. Should Tanaka just come in for one inning or two, or are they really going to hold firm and only look at him as a starter? So I think that's something I would stay tuned for. If he can come in and face major league hitters for an inning or two, I don't see what the harm in that would be, especially when you're saying you want to have him on the mound working to professional hitters down in Florida anyway. You might as well just do it right in front of you at Yankee Stadium.
Is there any concern, and I realize to some extent they have to do what they have to do to get a guy healthy who's such a central part of what they're trying to do, but is there any concern for a guy where there was already some wonder about with the adjustment to the U.S. season and to pitching every 5 days, or maybe not every 5 days, but pitching on a five-day rotation sometimes. Is there any concern about having him go deep into this winter and maybe with whatever it is and then maybe cutting off or cutting short the winter? Is that a worry, or is it just not something they could afford to worry about because they've got to get this guy healthy and right and see what they've got?
Yeah, I think you just have to know what you have. I mean, don't forget, he's had plenty of time to rest. You know, they came into this year thinking that they might have to watch his innings closely, and that hasn't been a problem since he hasn't been on the mound since July 8th. So they have time, I guess, is on their side in a way. But you really need to roll the clock forward and know, can you count on this guy to be in your opening day rotation? I think that's the big question. And if there's any kind of health concern that tells you no, then I think that tells you what needs to happen. But as we've talked about in the past, four different doctors have said the rehab route is the way to go. There's no reason to have the surgery right now. Try this first. So they're in the process of trying it. It hasn't gone perfectly, but it also hasn't been a disaster. And he's healthy. He says he feels no pain. So as long as he doesn't feel pain, you keep him throwing and you keep trying to do the rehab route.
All right. Brian Hoch, thanks for talking ball here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com Blue Jays beat reporter Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, it's been overall a pretty good two-year stretch here for Melky Cabrera that's coming to an end in a disappointing way, but what's his future with the Blue Jays organization?
Yeah, it's going to be the top priority for Anthopoulos this offseason, I think. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty with a lot of guys on that roster, just with team options and some other guys hitting free agency as well. But I think more than anyone, the Blue Jays would like to get Melky Cabrera back into the fold. And I think the qualifying offer is probably going to loom large. I think the Blue Jays are going to extend that to him at the end of the season. And you know, as we've seen in a lot of cases, that can limit the market for opposing players. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Blue Jays kind of use that as leverage this offseason. I think they'll see what the market dictates for him, and they'll see if he's able to get a multi-year offer from some other teams. And, you know, because of his past, I don't think there'll be quite as many teams interested in him as there might be normally with a player of his skill set. So, but there's no question the Blue Jays need him back. I mean, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that Colby Rasmus is going to leave at the end of the season. And, you know, Anthopoulos, you just don't want to have two big holes, two big turnovers in the outfield. So getting Melky Cabrera back under contract would really, line up with the rest of that talent that the Blue Jays have in the order with Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion. They have these guys under control for a couple more years. They would like to do the same with Cabrera.
It's interesting. You mentioned the issues with Cabrera, the PED issue, but you look at his numbers, and the numbers he's put up this year are basically identical to the numbers he put up over the previous 3 years. He's been in the distribution he was a little higher in 12, a little lower in 13, but you look over the last 4 years, and he's basically the same hitter for the last 4 years that he was this year. Is there any reason Yasi Cabrera is not basically a 300 hitter, 350 on base, 450 slugging. That's the hitter he is. Is there any reason to think that's not the hitter he is?
No, I mean that you're right. I mean, he has that proven track record now. And I mean, last year was there were some overall concerns about him just with his mobility in the field, and it looked like he was kind of aging rapidly. And then you looked overall, and then the Blue Jays found that tumor in his back, and that was a major cause. It was a life threatening situation for him, and they were able to find that, diagnose it, and get rid of it. And this year he's been moving a lot better as well. I mean, he just looked a lot better all around, whether it was at the field or even at the plate. He looked like the guy he was basically in San Francisco, and you know, that's something that I think that they've basically figured out with him, and I think that for the most part they know what to expect, and he really is kind of the ideal hitter for the Blue Jays lineup, and the fact that you can slot him in between a guy like Jose Reyes and Jose Bautista. He's a really good fit in Toronto. I think he also really likes it with the Blue Jays. And, you know, he was saying all the right things last week, as you would expect a player in his situation to do. But, you know, he was vocal about wanting to return. And you always have to take those things with a grain of salt, because you never really know what kind of role that's actually going to play at the end of the season. Obviously, he's going to have to look out for himself and take the best offer. But, you know, I think there's a clear understanding on both sides that they would like to work out a deal when the season comes to an end.
Yeah, you mentioned the fit for the lineup. I don't want to geek out too much here, but he's an unusual hitter in 2014. In a game where power is everything, there's a lot of strikeouts, in a era of baseball where a 350 on base and a 450 slugging often go with a 240 batting average, he's a different kind of hitter, and I got to think there's value beyond just the sort of overall rates. There's value for any team, and particularly a value to a team built on hitting the ball out of the park, to a guy who hits a lot of singles and doubles.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you hit the nail on the head right there, and that the Blue Jays are a team that's built around power, and they need to find other ways to score runs, and you know, even though they didn't quite do that as much as they would have liked to this year, he was one of the guys who helped them do that. And when you have him at the top of the order behind Reyes, I mean, those two guys are able to kind of hit the ball all over the ballpark a little bit and get on base for the guys behind him, in Bautista and Encarnacion. And you know, and Cabrera does have the power there too, obviously. But I mean, the fact that you know, he's able to hit the gaps as often as he does, it just brings a whole other dynamic to that lineup. He would be a very, very tough guy to replace if he were to go elsewhere.
You talked a little about Jose Reyes. He's had an interesting year. There was a stretch early in the year where he was absolutely torrid, but overall, I think it's fair to say that overall he hasn't been, in some ways, the kind of hitter you'd hope he'd be. He's a table setter, and he's a table setter with a .326 on-base percentage. Is it a good or bad? Because he's been a pretty good player, but what has the kind of player that Reyes is changed at all? He's definitely gotten on base less this year. Is there some change in his approach? Is that just kind of what's happened?
Yeah, he's been a really tough one to figure out this entire season. He did have those stretches where he looked very, very good, and then he'll go through stretches where he looks pretty bad at the plate. And some of it has at times been a lack of patience. I think he tried to force the issue a little bit, especially when the Blue Jays had some of their injuries earlier on this year. I think he put a lot of pressure on himself to kind of be the guy, the spark plug at the top of that order and really get the job done. You know, he still approaches things the same way. It's just, you know, I often wonder how much his legs have been an issue this year, because, you know, the stolen bases are still there, but there just seems to be something missing in his overall game. And it's been very, very obvious on the defensive side as well. I think the Blue Jays have some real concerns about him going forward with his overall defense because of the range that he has displayed at shortstop this year. Has been pretty concerning. You know, there was concerns about that last year as well, and you know, a lot of that had to do with the ankle injury, or at least that was what was thought at the time. And you know, but this year he's been able to stay healthy for the most part. He had that hamstring injury at the beginning of the year, and he came back probably before he was 100% healthy. But he battled through it and has played the rest of the season. So it's not one of his injury-plagued seasons that he's had in the past. He's been able to put up a high number of games. It just hasn't been the prototypical Reyes that a lot of people have come to expect from him. And whether it's been at the plate, whether it's been at defense, it's been a tough year for him. And they can only hope that, next year that they see, a guy more that people would have seen in Miami and before that in New York.
Does that risk becoming any kind of an issue going forward if there are issues about how well he can handle shortstop? Are there issues for a guy who's 31? That doesn't tend to get better. That tends to get worse. Is there anywhere on the radar some notion that before this contract is out, maybe he's a second baseman or something else?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest concerns that there should be with the Blue Jays organization right now is that, I certainly don't expect this to happen within the next year. I just don't anticipate the Blue Jays asking him to move positions next season. Second base would be the logical move, especially considering the Blue Jays also have a hole there. I don't think it's gotten to that point right now. But when you talk to some people in that organization and on that coaching staff, there are very legitimate concerns. And you look at even just the past week alone. There's a situation where the Blue Jays blew a 9-8 lead last week in Boston, and there was a number of balls that went through the left side of the infield that a lot of shortstops would have been able to make, but his range really to both sides has just been very, very limited, and there's a lot of balls that are getting through that other shortstops would have made, and that is a major concern. And you're right, typically these things don't usually get better. That's why I'm kind of curious to see how the Blue Jays spin this in the final news conferences of the season, and when Reyes maybe comes clean a little bit more. I do wonder if the legs have been bothering him a little bit more than that they've been letting on, because it seems to be the rain seems to be declining at a very quick rate, faster than you would expect. So maybe that is one that would be the only cause for optimism if there was a kind of injury that the Blue Jays aren't really letting on that could be impacting those type of things. But overall, you're right. I mean, those things don't normally get better with age. And when you have a big name like that, I mean, that's what you also have to play politics a little bit within that clubhouse. So I wouldn't expect Reyes to be open to a move next year, but it could be something that before his contract is up, maybe 2 years down the line, you're talking about a position change.
Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking a few minutes to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter, Bill Chastain. Bill, about 3.5 weeks ago, the Rays were 61-61. They were hot. They'd gotten back to that coveted 500 spot. They were at least on the fringes of the wild card race. Since then, they've gone 8-14. They've basically fallen out of the race. What's happened here over this stretch that is really disappointing, considering how hard they worked to get back into it?
I think it was predictable. I think everybody kind of anticipated it would have been hard to maintain the pace they were on. I think they really just kind of ran out of gas. They had that long stretch in May that really put them behind the eight ball, when they went 1-14. And then they played catch-up ball, and they were playing 700 ball. But, as anybody who follows baseball knows, you just can't keep playing 700 ball. And I think it finally just wore them down.
Do you think that there's some element of it just – takes so much to get to that point? I mean, it seems like maybe that's kind of what you're saying, that there's some, to some degree, you have to put so much in that maybe you get a little away from playing every day, like one day, and you start playing almost every day in kind of a playoff mode, and it just kind of wears you out.
Yeah, and also I think psychologically it was kind of like, well, we got to get to 500. And then when they finally got to 500, it's like, that was kind of like reaching a high bar because it was way out of range. I mean, they were 18 below 500 at one point. So here they reach 500, and then it's kind of like, you try to catch your breath, and the other teams aren't waiting. So I totally agree with you. I just think it's just a lot to ask after you have that kind of stretch.
We had a story on Rays.com this week about Desmond Jennings, said he's not progressing, excuse me, he might be done for the year. Is that your understanding that we may have seen the last at-bats from Jennings this year?
Given the team situation and the fact that he didn't come on this trip, I really don't see a reason why they would want to push him to come back. So you know, my read on it would be, yeah, I think he's probably done for the year. And, you know, given the fact that they've got all these outfielders and, you know, at the end of the year they're going to have to sort through the bunch and see who they want to keep and what their plans are for next year. I just don't see any reason, and nothing really makes sense for bringing him back.
And that, excuse me, that kind of leads me into my next question. Jennings hasn't really progressed. He's basically the same hitter in 2014 at age 27 that he was in 2012 at age 25. First, is that a surprise or a disappointment that he's not? There was some notion he had star potential, and he's a good player, but he hasn't really gone beyond good player.
No, I totally agree, and he actually seems to kind of regressed a little bit in the speed department as well. So, you know, who knows? Maybe, you know, a lot of times these guys are nursing an injury and we don't find out about it for, you know, the whole year. So who knows? Maybe his knee's been bothering him, you know, more than he's acted or played like all year. But I definitely agree. I think everybody thought that he could step right in where B.J. Upton left. And, of course, B.J. hasn't played well for the Braves, don't get me wrong. But it just hasn't been, you know, it definitely has been unfulfilled potential, I think.
Why beyond health, it's really about 3 years now that this is kind of the hitter he's been. Why do you think it is that over the longer view he hasn't taken that next step forward, given the obvious talent, given the potential, given how highly regarded he was?
You know what? I say you say beyond health, but really health has been, he's been dinged up every year. I mean, whether it's been his wrist, whether it's been his knee, whether it's been, you know, his shoulder. He's had health issues the whole time, so I really haven't seen him in a stretch where he's been able to play healthy. I think playing healthy is the biggest thing for him, and he just hasn't been able to do it.
So do you think there's a big year, a star-caliber year still in this guy?
You know what? I'm beginning to think he is what he is. I harken back to B.J. Upton again, too. It's like, you know, when the Braves signed B.J., you know, they thought that they were – you know, some of the comments you heard was, you know, he's got a high ceiling. I think sometimes you reach that ceiling and it's there. So I think based on the body of work, I would almost be surprised now to see him do more than what he's done thus far. And, you know, I think one thing a lot of people never understand is what a it is from being a triple-A hitter to a major league hitter. And, you know, those numbers just don't necessarily transfer to the major leagues.
He's not expensive yet, and he probably won't be expensive next year, but it's not that long before he starts getting expensive. What do you think Jennings' future with the Rays organization is?
Well, based on performance and based on when they have to start paying him, you know, which I haven't looked, you know, I don't have the figure right in front of me, but, you know, I think right now it doesn't look long term. I think based on the way they roll guys in and out, you know, and if you're something special, they might try to do something, particularly position player. But, you know, I would not be surprised to not see him be a long-term guy with the team.
To bounce to another.
Which, you know, based on what you were saying, too, I totally agree with you. He was, you know, he was grade A beef coming out of the minor leagues. You know, they thought this guy was the next great thing for them. And even you know, he's a strong guy. And you thought the power would come on a little bit. Really, the only obvious thing is his arm is not that strong out in center field, but he gets the balls and has good angles. He does a lot of good things. It just hasn't been, you know, the Superman that he was forecast to be.
And that's why you kind of wonder if some other club, it's sometimes like, you know, you got a pitcher with a big arm and every pitching coach thinks they're going to turn him into a superstar. You kind of wonder if a guy with those kind of tools, if some other club says, yeah, we know what can unlock that, and maybe he has significant value to another club who sees that potential and gets excited about what he might be in the future.
Well, you know, truthfully, in the field, he was a really good left fielder. I mean, not that he's a bad center fielder, but I thought he was above average left fielder. But, you know, most people, they, you know, tease about the left fielder being the National League's answer to the DH. And in the American League, you know, normally it's a guy with the weakest arm and, you know, pretty big bat. But I wouldn't be surprised when Kiermaier's been playing. If he does, you know, if you see Jennings back out there next year, I wouldn't be surprised to see him out in left.
To bounce to another homegrown guy or partly homegrown guy, minors guy. Will Myers is getting hits, but he's not hitting for any power at all. The average is coming up, and he's getting hits. Do you see – are you encouraged by what you see, or is there still some concern that the power is not there?
You know what? I think based on how he started the year, I think he really wanted to, you know, get to where he was just hitting the ball again. I mean, his stroke was off. His left hand hurt before his right hand. He just had a lot of things going wrong for him. So I'm sure he's in the camp right now where he thinks if, you know, he can hit the ball hard, it's going to start going out of the park sooner or later. And he is a guy who can be streaky. I mean, he can put a lot of home runs up in a hurry. So, you know, if it happens, you know, I think I wouldn't be surprised. I am a little bit surprised right now that we haven't seen more of it, though.
Have the organization's expectations for him in the medium to long term changed at all, or do they just chalk this up again to a year where a guy's hurt and you just can't, you just kind of start fresh next year?
I think it's probably mostly injury. I mean, when a guy misses as many games as he did, it's kind of hard to put a critical eye on him. And based on the fact, too, that he actually hurt his left hand, you know, like in the fourth or fifth game of the season, and really wasn't right with his left hand, I think it's pretty hard to be too critical of him. Hands are everything when you're hitting.
Oh, absolutely. It's the scariest injury you can have. It's like a shoulder for a pitcher. That's the kind of thing that just terrifies you. From the more positive news, we had a really interesting piece from your associate, David Adler, on Drew Smyly and his assortment. And I thought it was interesting the things they have unlocked in him. We've talked a little about him. I don't know that anybody thinks he's a one, but do you think maybe he's more than a three or four?
You know, based on what he's done so far, it's kind of, you know, you kind of think that. Of course, everybody has, you know, you try not to get too giddy about it because, you know, guys will have stretches. But I do know that they said they worked with him on some stuff about pitch sequences. He wouldn't go into great detail, but he was, you know, when he first got over here, and he was saying it was something that they hadn't seen in him in Detroit. And, you know, you've hardly seen him pitch a bad inning of ball for the Rays. So it's really hard not to be too optimistic about him, I think, going forward.
It's it could really look like a really good rotation. They might almost have more guys than spaces for next year. Is there any potential for them? I mean, I guess there's always potential for the Rays to get creative, but is there any potential for them looking to once again maybe move a starter to do something for their offense over this winter?
Oh, I think there's that potential is definitely out there, particularly when you got, like you say, you got five. You're ending the season with five pretty solid starters, and then you've got Matt Moore coming back probably in June next year. And then you got Colome and Eni Romero right on the back of that. But, you know, the one thing that, you know, they are always apprehensive of is they don't want to run out of starters because they really can't go to market to buy starters. And it's really, you know, who they've been. Who knows? I mean, you know, it might be somebody might be interested in the Hellickson, or but he might be the only one I would say might be on the open market. But, you know, Andrew Friedman's always been kind of like, you know, every player on my team is for sale if you got the right deal. But they definitely still need some hitting.
All right, Bill Chastain, thanks for chatting here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter Ian Brown. Ian, Will Middlebrooks a couple years ago looked like a guy who, even if he wasn't a completely well-rounded hitter, was going to be a pretty good ball player and a regular at third base and at least a cheap sort of cost-controlled option for the Red Sox for years to come. That hasn't happened, and in fact, he's been even worse since his recall than he was before. What happened to this guy?
Yeah, it's really mystifying, Matthew, because, you know, the one thing that's a real premium on these days is, you know, a right-handed corner infielder with power. Those guys are hard to find. And in 2012, the Red Sox really thought that they had a guy who could be their third baseman for, you know, at least the next, you know, 5-6 years. And he was their one bright spot they had in that entire debacle that was the 2012 season under Bobby Valentine. And then, you know, last year he comes in. They were so excited about him that they had Mike Lowell come in for a couple of days during spring training just to work with him on his defense because they thought, you know, that was really the next step for him. And then, you know, just a kind of a, you know, he would just rotate between injuries and inconsistency at the plate. Couldn't stay healthy, and then when he was healthy, couldn't hit. And it's just continued into, you know, there was a great optimism going into this year again because, you know, he was the quintessential player who had a great winter last year, you know, worked out, looked noticeably sort of, I thought, stronger, seemed stronger in a good way, and again seemed poised to get back on track and got off to another slow start, had injuries right out of the gate, just hasn't been able to get anything going offensively. So they're really confused because there's no, you know, I think we talked on this podcast before about Jackie Bradley Jr. and maybe some disconnect with, you know, what they're telling him to do and what he's actually doing. There's no disconnect here between the Red Sox and Will Middlebrooks. They love his enthusiasm. They feel like he works on everything they ask him to work on, and all the pregame stuff, and it's just not translating onto the field. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be the Red Sox that have to make that decision, you know, going into next year. You know, do you cut bait on this guy where he literally doesn't have much value right now, or do you, you know, give him yet another chance next year?
Yeah, and I want to get to that in a sec. In the meantime, is it as simple as just not controlling the strike zone? It was always an issue for him, but I'm just wondering if anybody, is this just a complete mystery, or are there reasons why this guy hasn't hit more? Again, he doesn't control the strike zone, but there are guys who strike out four or five times as much as they walk who are not hitting 190.
Yeah, you know, he has made a kind of a concerted effort to be more patient, and the amazing thing is the amount of times he has struck out looking lately, just almost being too tentative and maybe trying too much to change his approach. I think he struck out in Yankee Stadium last week in one game. He struck out four times, all on off-speed pitches, looking, you know, in the same game, and just kind of looked like a mess right there. So I think the interesting thing is that the Red Sox are trying to get Will Middlebrooks to play winter ball this year, just to make, because he's lost a lot of at-bats. And this is the other thing that I think is hard, is he's lost so many at-bats because of injuries that he's having a hard time making that up. And I think he always feels like he's trying to play catch-up when he gets back. So I think they feel like maybe winter ball would be a good setting for him to go out and just kind of get reacclimated to baseball a little bit and just get in a pressure-free zone there where not many eyes are on him and just see if he can get back to the guy that they think he can be. Will thus far hasn't said that he's definitely going to do that. I know the team continues to be in discussions with Will about playing winter ball. So, you know, I think it would be a good thing for him if he would go out and do that.
And then the other thing you touched on some, is there a place for this guy on the team next year? Is there a spot for him? It's not like they necessarily are going to owe him a lot of money, but they've got to figure out what they're doing at third base. Is there a spot for him on the roster in 2015?
Well, yeah, because third base is one of the few spots on this team where there's a great deal of uncertainty where you can't look at it right now and say, you know, who's our third baseman for next year and see a clear guy. You know, you have Brock Holt, who certainly had a nice year as a utility guy. I still think in a perfect world for a good baseball team that's in contention, Brock Holt is the perfect guy to come off the bench and be a super sub. I don't see him as a, you know, 600 bat player for a championship team. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll prove me wrong, but that's the way I see it. Garrett Cicchini, another prospect they're high on, hasn't yet hit for power that you might look for a corner infielder. Very good pure hitter. Really does have control of the strike zone, unlike Middlebrooks. Really patient eye, so not sure they're quite ready to bank on him. So the interesting thing for the Red Sox is, do they go out and spend money for a third baseman this winter? I think there's a few out there on the open market, and is that where they spend some money, is to get a third baseman, because it's hard to really bank on Will. And then, you know, you have the option with Will. You know, he still has minor league options. So do you trade him this winter, or do you kind of bring him back and see if he can boost some of his value back up and then trade him? It's going to be interesting to see exactly what they do with him.
Hey, you mentioned Holt, who really has kind of turned back into a pumpkin a little bit. And since the All-Star break, 278 OBP, 271 slugging. Not that this guy doesn't have value, but is this a case where a guy who maybe was over his head has been exposed a little bit? Again, not that he doesn't have value. I think he's a guy who, as you note, has some value to a club. But have we probably seen the best 3 months of Brock Holt's career?
Yeah, I think as an everyday player. You know, I think that we did. You know, I don't think it was necessarily a fluke what he was doing earlier in the year, because I think this guy is a pretty good hitter, has a pretty sound approach up there. Never going to hit for power, I don't think. But, you know, you look at his minor league numbers, and they were pretty good, too. And it's really opened my eyes about Brock Holt this year. It's just how versatile. I mean, this guy has played, not just played seven positions this year, but played seven positions pretty well, and you can't put a price on that. So I think what's happened is he's gotten tired. I mean, he's never had close to this many at-bats in a season. Doesn't have a big body, obviously, and I think that, like I said, I just think that he's a perfect kind of 300 to 350 at-bat type of guy, almost like, I think Daniel Nava is the same way a little bit. And just he's a good guy to have in your team, but not 650 plate appearances.
And then to go back to another thing you touched on, if Middlebrooks is not the guy, and it looks like, and they probably realize this as well, if Brock Holt is not the guy, what is out there? What are the options? Are there viable external options, either through trade or free agency, to be the third baseman for this team next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can always go out and find somebody. Look, I know Jed Lowry is, he's obviously had a hard time staying healthy. He really showed flashes with Oakland last year, what he can be when he's healthy. And he's a guy that's free agency, he's obviously familiar with the organization. And, the Red Sox have chips where they can make a trade for a third baseman. So I think that that market, there's not a complete clear picture of what that market is yet. But, I think that they'll go out and they can find somebody who can play third base for them next year.
Is it safe to say that with the outfield basically secured, that the third base and the rotation are the biggest questions facing this team for 2015?
Yeah, I think so. The rotation is just kind of a huge question mark. Right now you look at, you see one established guy in Buchholz, and I see, Joe Kelly, who I think you kind of know what Joe Kelly is by this point. I think, low, can be a lower rotation star, fourth or fifth guy on a good team. I think he showed that last year with the Cardinals. And then after that, you have all these young guys right now. So, I think that they're going to go out and sign or trade for a minimum of two starters over the winter. And there's great interest in who that's going to be because, a lot of people thought it was pretty gutsy that they would trade not just John Lester, but also John Lackey, who they had some control over for next season. So just to, just to trade two guys like that and just to be sure that you're going to be able to replace them. There's a lot of scrutiny on them this winter to see, what they do to replace those two guys.
And there's one other thing that could conceivably be a question that I think everybody hopes isn't, but Koji Uehara has scuffled and is kind of in a little bit of a limbo right now. I think a month or two ago, it would have been thought that if he wanted to come back, they'd want him back and they'd find some way to do another year or 2 years and make that work again. What's the status with him, not only now, but going forward? What is the situation? Is Uehara still on the table for 2015, or has that changed some?
Yeah, I think they hope he is. A really interesting point because you look at the July 31st trade deadline when the Red Sox were just pretty much trading anybody and everybody that teams were calling about. And they got I think Ben Sherrington said of all the players on his team, the guys who got the most calls on were Andrew Miller and Koji Uehara. And of course they traded Andrew Miller and got a pretty good prospect there. But Koji was the one guy that they said, look, we're going to hold on to this guy. Because I think at that point, Koji had been almost on a historic run for the last calendar year. The numbers he had put up between the time he took over as closer in middle of June of 13 until the trade deadline this year. So they say, okay, $14 million qualifying offer. That's a pretty easy decision for us. I think we're going to give him that qualifying offer and know that our closer role is going to be set for next year. And Cody's going to be 40 next year, so I don't think he would really be looking for a long-term deal. So we'll probably take the qualifying offer. But then all of a sudden he can't get anybody out, and his splitter is not splitting. It's just keeping up their belt high, and guys are putting into the seats all of a sudden. So now it's like, okay, is Koji Uehara in decline, or is this simply a guy who pitched deep into October last year and was leaned on pretty heavily by the Red Sox this year and is now just kind of paying the price for that? I tend to think that you see a lot of guys when they pitch deep into the playoffs and World Series, even guys who aren't 39, they kind of have that struggle at some point and hit a wall the next year. I think that that's what's happened with Koji. I think that right now they're shutting him down for a few days, and they're really hoping that, the last couple weeks of the season they can get a glimpse of him kind of being back to the Koji of old, being a guy they'd be comfortable bringing back. If not the closer next year, then at least, a key guy in their bullpen.
All right. Well, Ian Brown, thanks for chatting here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks everybody for listening.